Sutra books are passed out, and there were two, at least two, maybe three, but at least two sutras that we wanted to teach during this retreat. And one is the Discourse on Love, and that was passed out, so we'll do a little bit of work with that tonight. I don't think we'll get to it, but maybe if keep it at your cushion. One of the reasons we didn't move all the cushions around is because we're kind of getting a conglomeration of stuff at our cushions. You know, we got bowls, tea bowls, and we have we're gonna have little white cards, and we've got the maybe Thay's letter and the Discourse on Love. So kind of can keep those at your cushions. And so we won't move cushions around too much. And you can put things underneath your cushion. We will pass the sutra books in and out, though, just because they're bulky on one hand. And also, we don't like to put the sutra books on the floor. And, you know, different traditions hold that differently. So I know sometimes people put sutra books on the floor just for reading them, but the tradition I was trained in, you always hold the sutra book up, or you put it on your mat. It's not put on the floor where people's feet walk. It was how I was trained, so I pass that along. And back to you. In the early 90s, one time when I was at Plum Village, Thay gave me a copy of a chant, a refuge chant in Pali. And he said he wanted me to learn it. He gave me a tape of a cassette tape of him chanting it. And and so I duly learned it and was very happy. And then I never found it used anywhere any other time. But I had by that time always already fallen deeply in love with this chant. And so we have it in our sutra book, and I'd like to teach it. And it will be one of the refuge chants that we'll do throughout the retreat, and that we typically do here at Mountain Lamb, besides Tisarana. It's on page 30, the music. And we'll just learn the first page of it. But it's refuge, and you see the word Budo, Budam, Damo, Damam, Sango, Sangam. And it's taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And when we were in India last year, we heard various Southeast Asian sanghas chanting this as we went to the different sacred sites of the Buddha's life. And so it was really lovely to find that again. So maybe I'll do one line and then you can do it back to me. And then there's quite a few people who know it. So I think we first do it as call and response. And then after that, we can try it all together. And that little upside down V, when you see that next to a chant, it means we hold our hands in gassho. Usually when we're vowing or we're speaking the names of the Buddhas, we have our hands in gassho with palms together. So this goes, Adham Samam Sambuddho Bhagava. Araham Sammam Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadami Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadami Svakato Bhagavata Damo Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma Namasami Dhamma Namasami Supatipano Bhagavato Savakasango. Supatipano Bhagavato Savakasango. Sangam Namami. Sangam Namami. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Samam Sambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Samam Sambuddhasa. And we do that three times. Maybe we should do a little higher. I was hearing it sound pretty low. And the other thing I wanted to say about, you know, hands and gassho, you know, if you're just holding up your book, that's the same as having your hands and gassho. So it's hard, some, you know, it's hard to figure out how to, you know, how to do all this. But just holding up your book is just the same any time in the sutras. Araham Samam Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavato Dhammo Dhammam Namassami. Supatipano Bhagavato Savakasango Sanganamami. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Samasambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa. Wow. What a group. Beautiful. As we go on through the retreat, do you want to try to learn it all? Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe that's enough for today. We have two more pages, so we could pick up a second page and a third page later in the retreat. The Thais letter begins, "My dear children." And he really begins with talking about bodhicitta. And there was a moving passage from the Suragama Sutra that he had to learn and study. And it goes like this. As soon as possible, may I realize the fruits of the practice and to become a Buddha, so become a Buddha. In order to go into the world to help transform and liberate beings as numerous as the grains of sand in the Ganges, I vow with all the depth and breadth of my heart to serve every realm and to be worthy enough to repay for now the deep gratitude I owe to the Buddha. I invite you all to memorize that gatha and to commit it to memory so that when you sit down in the morning, you can say it to yourself. And it's, as I said last night, very helpful to memorize. Have something by memory that you recite because it calls forth that awake mind, that alert mind, that mind that has to be present in order to memorize and recite to yourself. And so it can be a way very much to very powerfully pull you in, into the present moment, right from the very beginning. And there's something also special about this particular gatha, in that it also is a very powerful statement of bodhicitta. It allows us, when we recite it, to focus our mind and to open our heart to the reason that we're practicing. And bodhicitta is like a seed. It's generative. And when we have a seed of bodhicitta, we plant it deep inside the heart of our practice. Bodhicitta leads us to practice. It grounds us in practice. And it becomes generative in our practice. For one thing, it cuts through all our appearances, all our self-identifying as Buddhist or as lay. It cuts through any self-importance that we have, any self-cherishing. And it cuts through any ideology. Sometimes when we come to practice, you know, we have an idea of ourselves as Buddhist, and then we have to act a certain way, and we have to look a certain way, and we think if we act a certain way and we look a certain way, we have this identity of being a Buddhist, that then our practice is, you know, everybody can see we're practicing, and it's enough. But really with bodhicitta, it cuts through all those appearances and all those attachments, because it asks us immediately to recognize that we're not practicing for self or for other. We're not practicing for identity. Rather, we're practicing to let go of identity so that we can realize something more deeply true about who we are. As Thay would say, we can look more deeply. When I received the 14 mindfulness trainings from Thay in 1986, it was before there were any monastics in our tradition, except for Thay. And he said to me, we went for a walk the day before he transmitted the 14 mindfulness trainings to me. And we went out to what he said was his favorite place in Upper Hamlet and sat down. And he said to me, you know, with this jacket, you renounce who you think you are. He said, it's like becoming a lay nun. And I think, you know, when we look at this letter, we see that it's most directly addressed to monastics, the monastic community. It refers frequently to monks and nuns. But Thay always said that, you know, the most important thing is that we're sincere practitioners and that we don't take on identities like lay or monastic. We don't take on identities of Buddhist or non-Buddhist. We let go of all of that. That when we are really practicing, we're renouncing our attachment to me and to you, all dualistic thinking. And I think that, you know, what I've sensed so far in this retreat is that everybody here is a sincere practitioner. And so this letter is really very directly addressed to each and every one of us. All of us who take up this path through the heart of bodhicitta, touching that seed of bodhicitta when we sit down on the cushion, so that we don't just get lost in thinking about this or drifting about around that, planning, taking up our projects, resolving difficulties. That we take ourselves in hand and come back to this moment, this breath, this body. And in that way, we begin to be able to do what Thay does in this letter, is to cut through some of our self-identification. One of the comments that he makes very strongly in this letter is that about 95% of, he says, monastics, but I think it applies also to us lay people, just want to be an abbot or a Dharma teacher or have this particular identity or that particular identity. And that's not what we practice. That just becomes an impediment to our practice, wanting to be something. And then he said, maybe 1% become scholars. And that means only 4% of people are really sincerely practicing. And so when we sit on the cushion, we can ask ourselves, am I sincerely practicing? But we don't even need to ask ourselves that much if we remember this particular expression of bodhicitta. And just recite it, and then don't worry. It's like planting a seed in the earth. We just plant it, and then we don't worry about it. We know it's there. We know it's beautiful. We know if we take care of it, it will sprout. It will send roots deep into the earth. And we don't really need to do too much more than that. The other thing that Thay points out over and over again in the letter is not to get attached in ideology. Even when we read the sutras, if we understand the sutras just through our intellectual mind, we'll get caught in misperceptions. And he points out a number of times when he found that misperceptions, ways he had misperceived the sutras or the way they were being taught, they were being taught incorrectly. And so he's asking us, you know, not to get caught in ideology, even Buddhist ideas, but to be looking carefully for ourselves and for the sake of all beings. Can't be looking just for ourselves. And we know that because self and other don't exist. If we're looking for ourselves, then we've made an inside and an outside. So in the particular gatha that we're memorizing, it says, in order to help in the world. It doesn't say to help you or to help me, but to liberate all beings. And that happens in each moment. It's not a grandiose scheme, but it happens right now. So we can begin after we have recited, memorized and recited the gatha. And you might want to write it down and have another little white card underneath your cushion. And it's okay at the beginning, you know, to recite as much as you can of it to yourself and then just pull it out and help yourself remember and put it away so that you can have some help in remembering. But, you know, more as important as remembering is touching that. Touching what that aspiration is expressed in that kata. And then very naturally and very easily, it's possible to just rest in our breathing. I recently read a quote from J.S. Bach, where he said, "I don't make music, music makes me." And when we are sincerely practicing, we aren't breathing. Our breath is breathing us. And we can touch that. No effort at all. And our breath fills our lungs. No effort at all. And our breath leaves us. And the only thing we need to make any effort at all to do is to let our awareness rest in that natural flow of our breath breathing us. And we can carry that into everything we do throughout the day. And it's natural then that we also just rest and drop into our bodies. And sometimes I like to think of mindfulness as not mindfulness, but as bodyfulness. One of the misconceptions I think that is happening in our world today is the misconception around mindfulness and what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is springing up all over the place, and I'm starting to think that whenever I say that word, I want to wash my mouth up. It's not that it's not important, but that it's become an idea. And once it becomes an idea, then the true experience is lost. And sometimes people say, "Oh, I'm mindful all the time." And as Kyra Jewell said yesterday, it's probably not possible. And to expect that of ourselves or to hold ourselves to that, then it takes us away from the real experience. So in this retreat, I hope we can practice bodyfulness in everything we do throughout the day. Put down our words. Put down our ideas. As long, you know, as we're filled with ideas, self and other, this identity, that ideology, this is the way it is. It's like being a vase full of water and nothing else can be added. If we add anything, it just flows all over the place, and we have a mess to clean up. But if we can be really practicing bodyfulness, aware every time we stand up, we're in our body standing up, not thinking standing up even, although if it helps cut through our discursive mind, then maybe we can say just standing up. But the real experience is beyond words of what it is to be in our body and our breath, what it is to stand up, what it is to sit down, what it is to walk, what it is to lie down. Every movement can be filled full of body. And when it's full of body and not thinking. It's like an empty vase, and it can be filled with wonderful things. It can be filled with the breezes and the trees. It can be filled with the call of the Steller's Jay. We can be filled with the blue mountains, the green trees, the smile of our friends. Nothing cutting us off, nothing separating us. Letting the universe fill us. Becoming kind of porous. And there's a kind of purification that happens in that, a simplifying. I found a poem by Wendell Berry that I thought was really quite beautiful. And it talks about planting the seed of aspiration and then emptying ourselves. It's called the purification. It goes like this. At start of spring, I open a trench in the ground. I put into it the winter's accumulation of paper, pages I do not want to read again, useless words, fragments, errors. And I put into it the contents of the outhouse, light of the sun, growth of the ground, finished with one of their journeys, to the sky, to the wind, then, and to the faithful trees, I confess my sins, that I have not been happy enough, considering my good luck, have listened to too much noise, have been inattentive to wonders, have lusted after praise. And then upon the gathered refuse of the mind and body, I close the trench, folding shut again the dark, the deathless earth. Beneath that seal, the old escapes into the new. Seed of our aspiration in the dark soil. Dark soil of our body. We don't see into our body. We sense our body. Just like when we plant a seed in the earth, we know it's present there. And the other thing about bodhicitta, about that seed, is that there's a great potentiality there. You can say everything is contained within it. And we call this potentiality emptiness. Empty of all things. Henry David Thoreau wrote a very beautiful thing about seeds. He said, though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders. You don't need to do anything about that seed, except to know it's there. Give it our attention, and let it sprout. In our vow, in our bodhicitta, we also find great strength. It is most natural in our lives, in all of our lives. Every one of us knows difficulty. There may have been great injustice done to us. We may have been maligned. We may have been misunderstood. We may have received a difficult diagnosis recently. We may have experienced a great loss. These things happen to all of us in our lives. And there's always the desire then to try to fix it, to make it different. A grasping at trying to change things that we don't want, and grasp after things we do want. This morning in our sutra that for Anapanasati Sutra, Full Awareness of Breathing, we read that we breathe in and we make our mind happy. We breathe in, we touch joy, we breathe out, we touch happiness. We breathe in, we make our mind happy. And sometimes we feel like when we read that, we've got to change ourselves. We've got to change what's happening inside ourselves. But the fact is, we can't fake it. If we fake it, we're just getting caught in those kind of appearances for the sake of others. It's a kind of, again, self-cherishing. But we can take refuge in our bodhicitta. And in that strength that we touch, there is a true happiness. It is not the happiness necessarily that our mind thinks happiness is supposed to look like or feel like, but the strength, the courage, to be able to be present with what is. Just as it is. And we say to ourselves, I vow to realize the fruits of practice and to become a Buddha in order to help in the world of suffering. And it's not my suffering or your suffering, it's not inside or outside. But we're able to touch that. And being able to touch it, hold it, know it, there is a sense of gratitude and happiness. I hesitate to use the word happy. But a fullness. And part of that fullness is that that very bodhicitta, those words bring us into connection. We are not alone. We may feel very much alone, but those very words help us to know that indeed we are not alone. There's no way we could ever be alone. That connection that comes from saying the great vow of a bodhisattva, the great vow of bodhicitta, we are met then by all the bodhisattvas and Buddhas who have walked this earth before us and with us right now. We are met by our great and beloved teacher, Thay. He's not somewhere else. He's right here with us. Because it is this vow, this bodhicitta, that he realized. And all that he asks of us to do is to realize it for ourselves. In the midst of suffering, difficulty, confusion, loss, fear, hurt, anger. Because the Buddha said that it is through suffering, by the recognition, acceptance of the fact of suffering, that we become free, that we liberate ourselves and others. So when in the sutra we read, we make our mind happy, it is not to say, oh, there's no suffering, there's no difficulty, there's no hurt, there's no upset. But it's to acknowledge that it is there, and then turn our mind to bodhicitta, that great strength to be able to say, I can be here in the midst of it. And I will be here until we see through it. Whenever we recite a true bodhisattva vow, as this particular gatha is, we feel, you know, the great strength of all of those people, all of those beings who have made that same vow, that they are there completely supporting us. There's no space, there's no time interfering with that. And whenever we can remember to turn to that vow and let it inform us, let it be our bodyfulness, let it be our mindfulness. Then in that very instant, we cut through the story that feels like the substantial reality. You know, in this world today, I mean, there is the very personal suffering, which we all have in our lives. And there is also the great fear that comes from looking at the suffering in the world. The suffering of war, of displacement, of great injustice, of climate change. And all of those bring up a great deal of fear and helplessness. And yet, if we, you know, don't let our bodhisattva vow, our bodhicitta, protect us, we will run away in distraction, in consumerism, we will be buried in our fear. And that is like the substantial reality that we live in the midst of. And in some level, you know, it's always been this way. The fear of dying, the fear of loss. You know, the real horrors of inequality and war and pestilence. And when we look at that, our immediate response is, I have to do something to fix this. And that response comes from a place of scarcity and fear. I got to change it. I got to make the world better. And that's when we're caught in just looking at what we see as a tangible reality. The Buddha tells us to look more deeply than that, not to get caught there, That is just the place we begin. We have to begin with knowing and acknowledging that there is suffering, that there is old age, sickness, death. So, you know, he holds up a pretty strong mirror right at the very beginning of what he has to say to us. But what is essential is that we don't get caught there. And one way we don't get caught there is by having bodhicitta, planting the seed within us that I vow, with the support of all bodhisattvas and buddhas throughout space and time, to liberate myself for the sake of all beings. And when we say that, we don't know what that means, and we don't know how we're going to do it. And that's really a very wonderful, wonderful place to be. So often, people say, what do I do about this? I mean, and it might be sort of the little issues in our lives. Should I join this club or should I take this class? You know, knowing that I have limited time. You know, it might be something small. And what I say is to live in the question, whatever your question is, however small or big it is. And let the question bring you back to the bodyfulness. What's right here? Be able to rest in it. And it's like resting in a level of darkness. Because we don't know. And when we don't know, there is this sense of darkness. But you know, when we start to talk about dark and light, you know, again, our ideas immediately come up like dark is scary and bad, and things go bump in the night. But also darkness is the womb from which everything arises. Darkness is the great earth that accepts and holds all potential. And so becoming comfortable with that, being able to rest in the darkness and in not knowing, being okay with that, we find that then we don't have to run so much. We don't have to chase after things so much. We don't have to escape from things just as they are. You know, Dogen has a really beautiful quote about this. He talks about there's a sense of darkness at the center of the phenomenal world. And the effort to penetrate the dimension of darkness with consciousness leads us to realize a larger whole that is both fertile void and the luminous ground. When we empty our minds of all substantial reality, we touch this, a sense of darkness at the center of the phenomenal world. Our efforts, which is bodhicitta, that is the only effort we need to make, is to penetrate the dimension, this dimension of darkness with our consciousness. And it leads us to realize a larger whole that is both fertile void and a luminous ground. And it allows us to touch this last aspect of bodhicitta that I'd like to talk about. And it is the bodhicitta that Thay talks about. It is the pure, innate, luminous mind Pai calls it the mind of love. And it is innate to all of us. It is innate to all sentient beings. It is who we are. Hakuin Senji has a really beautiful poem that we've read many times here. It says, all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. And that means otters and orcas, salmon and bear, red cedar, spruce, maple. This pure luminous mind is innate to even the stones and the mountains and the fields, as it is to you and as it is to me. And when Pai calls it the mind of love, it's just like the happy mind. It isn't our mind idea of what love is, because it cannot be known through our notions or our conceptual thinking. We come to know this happiness, this mind of love, only when we drop all our ideas, all our concepts, and self and other fall away. In the Vedas, it speaks about it this way. I am the taste of the water. I am the radiance of the sun and the moon. I am the sacred Om in all the Vedas. I am sound in space. I am the sweet fragrance of earth, the heat in the fire, the life in all beings. Know me as the seed of primeval of all beings. I am the strength of the strong. When the strong is untainted by desire and grasping, I am the love that moves all beings. This is the luminous mind, and this luminous mind is bodhicitta. It is our true nature, our innate mind. Everyone in this room already has touched this, or we wouldn't be here practicing the way we are practicing here. It is who we are, always unborn and undying. And right now, it might be a great faith for us to realize that, and a great faith that to realize that things as they are okay, are just right. And it's only from that place of abundance, fullness, of love, goodness, that place of realizing nothing is separate, that compassion arises that allows us then to respond to the suffering in the world. It is from that place that we step forth into the world of suffering with clear eyes and empty hands, not having answers, not trying to fix things, but from that deep knowing that we are never separate. I love this letter of Thay, and I love it because I think he is telling us again what he thinks is the most important things for us to understand from his teaching, and not to get lost in consumerism. There's a kind of consumerism, I believe, that is fairly rampant in American Buddhism. And it's always to be seeking after another practice. Very frequently people come to me and they say, I say, what do you do in your practice? And they say, I sit down and I do 5 minutes of metta and I do 10 minutes of tonglen. And then I do a 20-minute body scan. And then I sit, I journal about what my experience was with that. And then I do three prostrations. And that's my morning practice. And of course, there's nothing wrong with any of those practices. They are all wonderful practices and have each offer their own gift. But it's a grasping after something. When all we need to do is sit and let our breath breathe us. Let the universe be our whole life. Nothing more. We're not getting anything. We're just letting go. We're just renouncing. We're just giving up. That's all we do. And when we forget, then we've touched that true bodhisattva vow that I'm willing to sit here and be wide open to whatever comes, solid, strong, for the sake of all beings, for the healing and liberation in the world. You know, the kind of consumerism I see is as, oh, I'm going to go hear this teacher speak tonight and that teacher speak tomorrow, and this person teaching that practice over there. And we're running around to here and there and everywhere when all we really need is right here. Not chasing after things. Practices, teachers, ideas, things that need to be fixed. Always looking outside of ourselves, when it is really only by truly coming home to ourselves that we come to know our liberation and the liberation of all beings. And Buddha Thay points to this over and over again in his letter to us. As students of Thich Nhat Hanh, we need to make that vow to ourselves and to our sanghas. And that's what we're doing. And in that vow, in that bodhicitta, that seed, Thay is there with us. All the sanghas are there with us. All the wisdom traditions are there with us. Speaking through us, moving through us. We just have to empty ourselves. And we do that over and over again by letting the universe breathe us. And knowing when we're standing up, that we're standing up. Knowing that when we're sitting down, we're sitting down. Knowing when we're chanting, we're chanting. Knowing when we're lying down, we're lying down. So our practice is really very easy, but it's not simple. And it does mean taking ourselves in hand to continue to practice bodyfulness throughout the day. So we can practice some bodyfulness now by having bells to stretch our legs and to be really in touch with ourselves as we stretch our legs and stand up. And then take maybe about 10 minutes if we need to use the restroom, or get a coat and put our shoes on and gather outside for walking meditation. Walking as a sangha, as a community all together. Each step, being fully in each step. Not thinking about where we're going, not thinking about where we've been, but putting our full arriving completely, our full being into each time we touch the earth. And it is like planting that seed of bodhicitta. Every time we touch the earth in that way, we give ourselves completely to the earth. All our ideas, all our suffering, all our striving, all our desires, all our wanting, all our avoiding, all our getting, letting it all go.